Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, June 11th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, wells get a new layer of Humboldt County review. 1.2 million acres designated as critical habitat for Humboldt Martin recovery. And City of Ukiah issues Juneteenth proclamation, celebrations planned. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The use of wells for all purposes is getting more scrutiny from Humboldt County planners. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Lawsuits outside of Humboldt County are influencing the way the planning department reviews use of wells, with additional analysis happening. The new protocol isn't just for cannabis irrigation. It's being applied to all wells, including residential and other agricultural wells. County Planning Director John Ford briefed the Planning Commission on the new way wells are being reviewed at its June 6th meeting.
There have been a couple of different lawsuits outside of Humboldt County that tend to cause us to want to be more conservative and treat wells as potentially discretionary, which would mean that they'd be subject to CEQA. And there is another set of laws related to public trust doctrine. And if wells are taking water that would affect the public trust, which would be surface waters, navigable waterways, then a finding needs to be made that the wells are not damaging the public trust. So under the current circumstances, all wells, whether it be a residential well, an ag well, a well for cannabis, they're all being evaluated for CEQA compliance and also for public trust.
Some commissioners vouched for even greater expansion of well analysis, shown in this exchange between Commissioners Ivor Skavdal and Peggy O'Neill.
You know, I hate to put in this like one more thing on these projects, but I think it would be good for the applicant to actually know the actual capacity of their wells, and for us to base storage on a more scientific analysis of the well drawdown and actual pumping capacity when we're setting storage requirements. And I think CDF is often struggling with that same kind of question and being very conservative on the storage requirement because we don't actually know well capacity. So I don't know if that's something that we could look into and see if there's some standards or something that perhaps environmental health could look into or that we could get to help us
that's exactly know actual well capacity. What I totally 100% agree, because my experience with wells is that I don't know how we have so many great wells associated with these projects, because I've probably been involved with, you know, over 20 drillings or more, and never are they consistently great producers.
One thing that won't get analysis is well water quality, as explained by Ford when O'Neill asked about it.
Is treatment required on any of these wells?
We do not have water quality standards within the county right now.
So for a health, from a health standpoint, because I don't know enough about cannabis, I know like you can contaminate lettuce or whatever. So we don't worry about that?
We worry about protecting the resource and the access to the resource. So it's really about protecting the borehole.
What happens after that is somebody else's concern?
Yeah.
There was also discussion about the impacts of a project's well use on neighboring wells. Ford said analysis of that has been ongoing ever since the state's governor issued an executive order requiring it. Also at the meeting, commissioners approved about 2 acres worth of cannabis farming in the Alder Point area, half of it under the county's relocation and remediation program. Permits for about 2 acres of mixed light cannabis cultivation, a mix of new farming and farming relocated from an environmentally sensitive site were unanimously approved, along with 10,000 square feet of existing mixed light cannabis and an 8,000 square foot commercial nursery. The project's water is sourced from a well, but over 800,000 gallons of water storage is included. Power is provided by solar arrays and a backup generator for emergencies, but PG&E power is forthcoming, and the permits disallow the mixed light cultivation until the grid power is in place. There were no significant issues, and the permits were unanimously approved. At the helm of the farming, under the business name Humboldt Heritage Farm Management LLC, is Nakona Mendez, who has several active farm licenses in the county. He was described by a representative as a South Fork High School graduate who grew up in Redway. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, the city of Ukiah issued a Juneteenth proclamation with celebrations planned. KZYX's Sarah Reith shares this report.
The Ukiah City Council issued proclamations recognizing gay pride, the contributions of immigrants, and Juneteenth last night. African Americans have long celebrated June 19th as the real Independence Day because it's the anniversary of the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, finally learned they had been freed. Councilmember Juan Orozco read some history from the city's proclamation.
Whereas President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863, paving the way for the passing of the 13th Amendment, which formally abolished slavery in the United States of America, and whereas more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation declaring the slaves in Confederate territory free, roughly a quarter million enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, finally received word that they were free from bondage on June 19th, 1865. And whereas Juneteenth, officially Juneteenth National Independence Day, is a federal holiday in the United States commemorating the ending of slavery and is celebrated annually in June 19th.
It will be thoroughly celebrated in the city of Ukiah, where Essence Roberson, Troil Tagnoli, and Nevaeh Travis were among those who filled the seats in the chambers to hear the proclamation and listen to Roberson's remarks as she accepted it. Afterwards, they shared details of the celebrations they've planned.
I am Essence Roberson. I own Tea Up Ukiah and McCormick's Tea Lounge here in Ukiah, California.
My name is Troil Tagnoli. I head up Black Lives Matter, and I'm also working on a Juneteenth event. Hopefully pairing up with Tea Up Essence for the first time. We're looking forward to a major expansion as we bring more and more of our African American community to the forefront.
And Essence, you accepted the proclamation by the City Council, and it's June 5th, but it seems like it's a month-long celebration. So can you give us a few more details about what you're planning to put on?
Right. It is a month-long situation, but that's okay because we're only just beginning. What we're going to be doing for this month is we're going to be providing an all-around experience so people can really immerse themselves in the culture and understanding of what Juneteenth is and what it symbolizes. We are a product of this, and so my event is happening June 15th. It's going to be from 1 to 8 p.m. There we will have music, food, culture, vendors. We'll also be graced with the presence of Miss Gloria Scott, who used to be one of the IGETs and also one of the Supremes. So we're very excited to also see a new range of talent. And this talent is not just from the African-American community. It spans different, the many vast cultures of our community. And then we are going to be teaming up and having some of the same talents and some of the same experiences with Troils and the Black Lives Matter movement event, which is happening on the 19th. And we're very excited to be pairing up this event. You're going to be immersed in, again, the food, the culture, and more importantly, the education behind why this day is so important for everyone to know about and celebrate.
And Troil, can you share some more details about what's going to be happening on the 19th at the MEC?
You know, this is such a great time because sometimes we lose faith. And what happens is that we all just merge together one day and we go, hey, wait a minute, let's do something fun together. So for me, Black Lives Matter, the MEC, you know, living here forever, watching my young people, there's a lot of our young talent that we're going to be showcasing this year. And it's just a beginning because we have some serious talent here. So on the actual 19th, it's a Wednesday. We're just being true to form and I get a little lazy. So it's a 4-hour event. It's going to be all of the traditional foods. I mean, the really good food is $25 a plate. And that's a donation because we're trying to raise money again for our up and coming generations. We have third and fourth generations of African American youth in our community. And you would not know that. I mean, and there are resilient beyond words. And so to show, to have this opportunity to showcase them is really important. And so we'll have a little music. We have Gregory, who's going to be on the piano. Essence is doing a fantastic job over at Tee Up that weekend. And so we'll start that Wednesday and we'll just power through the week.
Who are some of the young performers that we're going to hear? We know that we're going to get someone from the Supremes, who's just an icon of American musical history. So I have a feeling maybe one of the young performers is here.
Yes, she is. Uh-huh. And she is young Nevaeh Travis. She's a third, fourth generation singer.
I've been, you know, in a family of, like, generational addiction, and I'm in recovery now, and I'm breaking free from those chains, you know, and so my music that I write is all about freedom and freedom from active addiction. So I'm going to be sharing some of those songs at the Juneteenth event and the event on the June 15th. And I'm really nervous and excited, but I decided, you know, like I want to put myself out there and I want to share with other people that you can do it. That you can make it out and be okay.
So it sounds like this Freedom Day is freedom in so many ways for you.
Yeah, it's freedom. It's just all over freedom. I'm really happy and excited and honored to get to perform at this event.
And you'll be at the MEC or the Tee Up or both?
Both, yeah.
The June 19th celebration at the MEC is from 4 to 8 p.m. at 106 West Stanley Street in Ukiah. The June 15th celebration at Tee Up Ukiah is from 1 to 8 at 125 South Orchard. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Reif. For all our local news, with photos and more, visit kzyx.org.
Following a court-ordered agreement earlier this month, the Fish and Wildlife Service has designated more than 1.2 million acres of critical habitat in northwestern California and southwestern Oregon for the threatened Humboldt Martin, a small carnivorous mammal native to the coastal forests of northern California and southern Oregon. The Humboldt Martin was once thought to be extinct due to the extensive logging and habitat loss. However, small populations have been rediscovered. In 2010, the Center for Biological Diversity and the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC, petitioned to list the Humboldt Martin as protected under the Endangered Species Act. However, Fish and Wildlife delayed the actual protecting of the animal until 2020. Today, fewer than 400 Humboldt Martins remain in just four highly isolated fragments of their historic habitat, which has been reduced by 93%, according to the Center for Biological Diversity.
Yeah, so it's really exciting. The species was listed as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act in 2020. So, you know, we have been waiting a bit of time to get this to get their habitat actually protected, but it couldn't come soon enough, and we're really excited about it.
That was Chelsea Stewart Fusick speaking to us last week.
I'm an attorney in the Endangered Species Program and the Center for Biological Diversity. I work out of the Portland office and I do endangered species protection work. So that can include trying to get species listed under the ESA in the first place and can also include trying to combat some harmful projects that might harm those endangered species once they are on the list. So yeah, I mostly do litigation, a little bit of policy work as well.
The critical habitat designation calls for 5 units of protected habitat where martens are known to still exist. This includes acreage in Coos, Curry, Douglas, Josephine, Lane, and Lincoln counties in Oregon, and Del Norte and Siskiyou counties in Northern California.
Yes, so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service just designated critical habitat for the Humboldt Martin. They designated the critical habitat across its home range. And, you know, that home range has shrunk quite a bit compared to the vast amount of forest they historically inhabited. But, you know, their range has shrunk by about 93%. But the areas where they still are will now come with their habitat being protected. And the designation ultimately means that federal projects that are to take place within the critical habitat boundaries must go through consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service to ensure that any harmful impacts are avoided or mitigated to the extent possible. And this also applies to any project that requires a federal permit.
But this new agreement that designates critical habitat for the imperiled species, in part, exempts Green Diamond Timber Company's logging lands. In exchange for monitoring the creation of a 2,100-acre reserve on land and a highly speculative proposal to relocate martens to a national and state parks.
And, you know, to be clear, these consultations very rarely result in a project being unable to go forward, but they do mean that the effects of the project will have to be analyzed a bit closer in the context of what the martin needs to survive. And this can result in conservation measures being put in place to mitigate any anticipated harm to martin habitat.
Martins are threatened by the ongoing logging of mature forests, loss of closed canopy habitat to wildfires, rodent poison, and vehicle strikes. Stuart Fusick explained that martens are on the brink of extinction, and with most of their habitat lost to logging, their populations cannot expand. She says if these animals are going to recover, they're going to need more than the disconnected habitat fragments the service just protected.
The Humboldt Martin really needs old forest habitat. And old forest habitats come with really complex structure. And that kind of structure you can't get from a young forest stand. So they really rely on these old growth habitat areas, as well as more mature forests that may not quite be old growth yet, but that is heading in that direction. They need to eat a lot of food every day to meet their energy demands. So it really becomes a problem when we don't have the habitat they need for their prey, or for them. One problem with logging as well, in addition to just removing the habitat they need, is that it also creates conditions that their predators really thrive in, specifically the bobcat. So we're seeing a lot of predation on martens by bobcats when they lack that canopy cover that would otherwise help them hide from predators.
The CBD attorney stated that she's happy that the Humboldt Martin finally has protection for some of the most important places they live, but believes that it shouldn't have taken multiple lawsuits to get here. Quote, "It's extremely disappointing that the service continues to give special treatment to timber companies, which are largely responsible for the martin's decline in the first place," end quote.
We're really worried about these areas that, you know, may not be great martin habitat right now, and that martins may not be in right now, but that, you know, if we want their populations to expand, we need to expand the areas that contain suitable habitat for them. And so, we were hoping that Fish and Wildlife Service would take a closer look at some of Green Diamond's lands. Green Diamond lands are situated in a place that could be a habitat connectivity corridor at some point for the martin. Ultimately, we are just a little concerned that the service protected only habitat that is occupied right now. The scientists, including the service's own scientists, have really emphasized the importance of habitat connectivity. And right now, their population areas, you know, there are only four isolated population areas. And so this fragmentation just means it will be harder to recover the species because those populations won't be able to connect with one another if we don't restore habitat in between them. Ultimately, we want martins to get off the endangered species list. We don't want to just maintain their really low numbers they have right now. We want to actually expand their population.
Moving forward, conservation measures include habitat protection, research on their population and ecology, and efforts to mitigate human impacts on their environment. In conclusion, we asked what comes next.
What comes next is that we hope to just see greater attention paid to their habitat needs. We hope to see that federal projects that go forward within their critical habitat areas, you know, are really analyzed closely, that we get some more conservation measures in place in those areas. This has been a really long fight to get here. We first petitioned, along with EPIC, we first petitioned to get the species listed under the ESA back in 2010. So, you know, it's taken several lawsuits since then, and to see us, you know, get that threatened determination that the species is threatened in 2020 was a really important thing. And now this critical habitat designation is really exciting too. So we're just hoping that the martin, you know, really benefits from this, and we expect that they will.
More on the ruling and other efforts to protect the Humboldt martin can be found at biologicaldiversity.org. In national news, environmentalists hold webinar on problem of plastic pollution. Audie McAfee with KPFA reports.
The organizations PEER, Beyond Plastics, and Oceana took part in a Zoom event Monday to discuss global health threats created by plastic pollution. According to PEER, 10 billion tons of plastic has been produced since the 1950s, and that number is expected to triple by mid-century. Megan Wolf is the Beyond Plastics Health Policy Director. The group works to ban all single-use plastics. Wolf says tiny microplastics that we can't even see are all around us in the environment.
You can be sure that if it's in the water and it's in the air we breathe and it's in the food system, it's in the vasculature of plants, it's in the animals that are slaughtered and brought to table, it's in us.
Beyond Plastics says microplastics have been found in the human body, such as breast milk, placenta, blood, intestines, and lungs. The group said it can cause cancer as well as affect the endocrine system, resulting in a loss of body functions. According to the group, only 6% of plastic is actually being recycled, and it's time to, quote, turn off the tap and halt the mass production of plastics. Christy Levitt is Oceana's plastics campaign director. Oceana is dedicated to protecting the world's oceans. Levitt says recycling will never keep up with the production rate of plastic, and that putting the burden on consumers to recycle is counterproductive.
Consumer good companies are simply putting too much plastic into the market and not offering plastic-free choices to consumers. So even if you want to avoid plastics, you really aren't given a choice when you go to the grocery store or the convenience stores. The shelves are just stocked with products that are packaged in plastics.
Christy Levitt says one solution is for companies to move to non-toxic, reusable, and refillable containers. She said that's why prohibiting the use of single-use plastics is so critical. Oceana found that 40% of all plastics used every year are single use. The Grand Canyon National Park implemented a water bottle ban in 2012 after finding that one-third of all trash in the park were plastic water bottles. 23 more parks followed suit. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, says the Grand Canyon reduced total waste by 20% and the amount of plastic it had to haul by 30%. This prevented 2 million plastic bottles from ending up in the environment. However, the Trump administration did away with the change in 2017. All of the organizations said plastic incineration is the worst option for disposing of plastics because they are made of fossil fuels, which emit greenhouse gases and other chemicals. Megan Wolf from Beyond Plastics says creating a reuse economy is the best solution, and it needs to happen before it's too late.
To dither, given how much plastic is being produced, how quickly, and what its impacts are. We need to move now.
All of the organizations recommend using plastic as little as possible and to call on lawmakers to pass laws doing away with plastics. For KPFA News, I'm Audie McAfee.
In international news, Gaza officials warn of malnutrition among children in the enclave. KPFA's Rami Amuleri reports from Gaza.
Here at the pediatric department of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza Strip, medical staff warned of a life-threatening situation for several children receiving medical care. Doctors say malnutrition and a shortage of vitamins could be direct causes. Five-year-old girl Razan Mohaisen is one of those children hospitalized here. Dr. Sharif Matar describes Razan's condition.
Razan, 5 years, female patient, a case of acute severe malnutrition, Kwashiorkor for disease due to protein deficiency.
Razan's mother, Arwa Mohaisen, also has a one-year-old baby. Mohaisen told Pacifica that she has had breastfeeding difficulties since the war.
I've got another baby boy that's 1.5 years old. Before the war, milk and other things were available at the local market. But now during this war, I've had to stop breastfeeding him. Also, things are sold at inflated prices. I can't find the milk that I prefer, and my own milk has become low. In the past, milk, yogurt, and juice were all plentiful. But now these things are hard to get. And if I find them, I can't afford the high prices because my economic situation has worsened.
Over the past several months, almost 1,000 truckloads of aid supplies have entered the Gaza Strip on a weekly basis. Local authorities here say Gaza needs at least 1,000 truckloads of goods and commodities each day. Ismail Thawabta is Director General of the government-run media office in Gaza.
For example, at this hospital, two children died of malnutrition several days ago. Local health officials, government officials, and international organizations like UNICEF and others say malnutrition is like a specter that threatens children's lives. There are 3,500 children in Gaza who could die without the necessary food, supplements, or vaccinations that they need immediately.
Al-Thawabta's warning comes amidst estimates by UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, that 9 out of 10 Palestinian children in Gaza are short of food and vitamins. Dr. Sharif Matar.
Each infant needs essentially vitamin D, which now there is severe deficiency in it, and need vitamin A to protect him. He needs other vitamins, which not easy to be deficient, but due to the chronicity of their conditions, it leads to the deficiency of other vitamins, like vitamin B1, B2, B12, vitamin C. Each single vitamin now became deficient due to the chronicity of the condition of malnutrition.
The World Health Organization estimates that 80% of the children surveyed 6 years or younger in Gaza have gone a day without eating. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sharon Wolf, Sarah Reith, Audi McAfee, and Rami Al-Mighari. KMOD News is online. You can find us on KMOD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send us an email to news@kma.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.